from the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Yes, yes, y'all. It's another edition of the Vibe Collective here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Jams, and joining me in studio, my co-host.
Is it not working? Try that one.
Kemba King.
Yes, yes, Kemba. Just taking care of some technical issues over there in the studio. And we are awaiting our other co-host, Adnan Hussein, who will be joining us very shortly. And I want to give a big shout out to two of our other co-hosts, Adrian Worrell, who is not feeling well today. I hope he feels better. And Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen, who just needed some downtime. And we definitely support her in that because she works very, very hard all day long, every day. So big shout out to her. We're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. From 3 to 4, we normally engage in roundtable discussions about things like decolonization, social justice, identity, the culture of resistance, and all those good things. And then from 4 to 5, myself or DJ Badnan or DJ Griffin brings you music to move you, which we will be doing this afternoon. And I want to welcome to the studio two guests, two return guests, though together for the first time in the Vibe Collective studio today. Ajamu Nangwaya, thank you for joining us. You are from the Pan-African Solidarity Network.
No, the Network for Pan-African Solidarity.
I had a little dyslexia with it. I could see it. But thank you for that correction. And thank you for joining us. It's good to have you in studio.
Thank you.
And Luam Kadani, it's good to have you here. You've joined us over the phone before.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to get you live in the studio. So it's great to have you here today for this discussion.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming through. So I want to wish you all... am I going to say this properly?
Habari Gani.
Yeah. For Kwanzaa. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to go on off on a tangent. My mother was going off about people not saying Merry Christmas, but then you said something different. Go ahead. I like to share stories about my mother.
Oh, well, Merry Christmas too?
No, it's just this kind of idea where she's saying like we always are apprehensive about greeting people during this time of the year, right? Mm. And, my mother is a self-identified Christian, and she takes issue with this idea of happy holidays, right? Mm-hmm. And I've learned not to have the discussion with her, but that's what came through my head when you started saying that.
Yeah. Well, I was saying Habari Gani because we invited our guests in today to talk about the principles of Kwanzaa. We've talked about it before on the show. But this year in particular, there are two teachings that I'm really interested in, the intersection of Umoja and Ujima. And I'm hoping that you both can speak to those teachings as well as what is today? Today is day 5.
Ujamaa. Yeah.
Okay. So that's today, which means unity. Yes?
Cooperative economics.
Cooperative economics. Yeah. Okay. So there are 7 days in Kwanzaa, and each day there's a different teaching that you celebrate and talk about. Do you all want to go in on this? Because I don't have a full grasp on the teachings of Kwanzaa, so you can all probably do a lot better justice than I can.
Go ahead, you can start.
Would you mind maybe just giving a history of Kwanzaa and where it originates from? Because I think this is the thing that a lot of people, including, you know, Africans from the continent and in the diaspora, need some clarity on. Mm-hmm. And I know that at one point I was having, I'll say, a discussion with someone whose parents are continental Africans, who basically talked about the fact that Kwanzaa is very made up and did not accept it as a valid way to experience this time of the year. So if you could maybe give that history.
Okay, before I even start the discussion about what Kwanzaa is and the values, I'd like to, you know, put it out there that anyone who's able to show me a holiday that's not made up, essentially created by people, I'd love to study that phenomenon because it's really a rare thing.
Ashe.
Non-existent, I would say. So all holidays are created by people to reflect values and principles, interests, and, you know, reflect the needs that they have. Mm-hmm. Well, Kwanzaa was started in December 1966, and it was created by Dr. Maulana Karenga. He was part of the US organization in LA. But it's not just Karenga creating this thing. It was created in a movement context of the African Liberation Movement in the United States, and this attempt by Africans to define ourselves, to represent our interests, and he, being a part of that movement and also someone who's an academic worker or a student, he did a survey of different African festivals and pulled together, he synthesized certain elements and put together Kwanzaa. So if you go to the continent, you won't find, well, actually, if you go to Zania, you will see they celebrate Kwanzaa there. If you go to Tanzania, you will see some communities celebrating it there. And actually, it is now a Pan-African holiday, even though it started in the United States. Mm-hmm. So it was created to reflect needs that we had and still have as African people to control our destiny, to define ourselves, and to present values that are oppositional to the white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal values that exist in society. So Kwanzaa has seven fundamental principles. And it forms part of the value set called the Nguzo Saba, which means the seven principle. And the first principle is unity, umoja. The second principle is self-determination, or kujichagulia. And the third principle, which is celebrated on the third day of Kwanzaa. Because Kwanzaa is a seven-day holiday, starting December the 26th until January the 1st. So the fourth principle, third principle is Ujima, which means collective work and responsibility. And the fourth principle is celebrated today, called Ujima, which represents cooperative economics, or means cooperative economics. And the fifth principle is called Nia, purpose. And the sixth, which is celebrated on the sixth day, is Kuhumba, which means creativity. And the last principle is Imani, which means faith. And all of those values represent a collective thrust of our community and of our people and our struggle for emancipation. So, you know, how I read them and how even the founder, Karenga, looks at these values, they represent a communitarian tradition. Because we're looking to Africans, okay, what elements of the cultures that we had in Africa that can be, and what elements in this culture can we use, harvest, update for our context today? Because culture is a dynamic process. And, you know, so those values are really, really represent oppositional value. Unfortunately, as Kwanzaa, you know, moves into the mainstream, it's accommodating itself to some of the oppressive values. And the liberatory thrust or oppositional thrust of Kwanzaa is kind of moving away as it gets greater acceptance. And it's not, and to me, it's not an unusual phenomenon, because if we have radical organizations and you start to get funding dollars, you start to get accepted by the mainstream, you start to accommodate yourself to some of the values that are there. And I think, well, let's make you.
I mean, and I think part of the reason that happens
part of the reason that there's a pushback is anytime that there's something that's created that the purpose is to decenter white supremacy from conversations, then there's going to be a pushback. It goes back to any type of organizing that you see, whether it's people wanting to feed each other without using state apparatuses, whether it's people trying to make sure that we're keeping our community safer without having to call the police in. Mm. Anytime that you see movement happening within the African black communities in the diaspora and in the continent, you're going to see a pushback from white supremacy, particularly when something is challenging it. And at the heart of Kwanzaa, the purpose is to decenter white supremacy, so not having to accommodate blackness within a movement of Christianity that centers whiteness, but rather to create a conversation around African identity, which is always fluid and dynamic, because we're fluid and dynamic peoples that all have a variety of experiences. And so when that happens, we have to be cognizant every day that when there's a power to be dismantled and to be pushed back, that we're going to create a situation where we have to continually have conversations within our movements about how we can respond to these threats from white supremacy. So it goes back to this notion around, for me, the real power behind Kwanzaa, whether it's that you believe in every single principle or whether it's because you want an alternative to Christmas or you want an alternative to Christianity. I think for me, the important thread through all of those is that you're creating an alternative so that our conversations don't always have to be in a reactionary vision. And so it goes back to what some like non-African people have said. Grace Lee Boggs is one of them, about creating conversations that are visionary as opposed to reactionary. And it's something that I continually get into heated discussions with people of African descent, with people from the continent and the diaspora, is how do we do this when we're so immersed in white supremacy? And how do we have these conversations without implicating ourselves? And so for me, I think the important thing about Kwanzaa is about implicating ourselves in white supremacy and also understanding the dynamic and fluid notions around white supremacy. So, yeah, I think in conjunction to what Ajamu said, those are the reasons that I think Kwanzaa can provide an important interjection into the conversations we're having.
Yeah, thank you both for that. And just something, just to touch back on what you said about, you know, holidays being made up and the way in which Kwanzaa came together, and perhaps something maybe for your mother to think about is, in terms of that cultural revitalization, there has to be a starting point. And in particular for people who have been transplanted and disrupted from their roots, you know, it has to be in a pan sense of the word, because of the continent being so big and people not always being able to trace their lineage necessarily back to Ghana. You know, it could be from other places as well. So, I mean, to me, that legitimizes Kwanzaa in itself. And then outside from that, the idea of having an alternative to, in particular, to the white supremacist institution of Christianity is essential for that sort of identity reinforcement and revitalization of identity as well. So do you want to talk a little bit about the teaching that talks about self-determination, since that, you know, certainly I think ties all of what you're saying together, for Kwanzaa at least.
Right. And the thing I'd also like to mention is that, you know, Kwanzaa is not a religious holiday, it's a cultural holiday. So you could be a Muslim, a Christian, an atheist like myself, and still participate in Kwanzaa. So it really reflects that kind of Pan-African and a basis for unity among our people. One of the things that I really love about Kwanzaa is this Pan-African character. So irrespective of your ethnicity as an African person or nationality, it's something you can embrace, because it's not something that's rooted among, like, the Akan or, you know, among the Zulus. This is truly Pan-African, that represents a sensibility. And I guess it could have only been created in the diaspora, because Pan-Africanism emerged in the diaspora, just the molding of different African peoples into one in dealing with the enslavement, white supremacy, and capitalist exploitation. But self-determination, to me, is very, very critical. Even as African people and also for oppressed people. Because one of the things, if we look at the seven principles They're very much universal values. If you talk about self-determination, and we see ourselves as people exploited as members of the working class, self-determination means that we need to break away from the cultural and political ideological conditioning of capitalism. And it's also for Africans who are part of the working class. It represents we trying to break away from our commitment to capitalist values. Mm. See, in the same level, white supremacy, same thing with patriarchy. Self-determination means, you know, you're going to define yourself. You're going to name yourself. You're going to set for yourself, set an agenda for yourself, an agenda of liberation. And I think today, more than any other point in our history, we need that. Because if we look at how we're responding to a crisis in capitalism, or as African people responding to white supremacy, we're not building movements, we're not building organizations that can effectively challenge how we are defined. And in a lot of cases, the very oppressed accommodate themselves to the values in the system, taking a path of least resistance. But being self-determining and pursuing Kujichagulia self-determination is something that we definitely need today.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you say really resonates, I think, with what we're seeing with the I Don't Know More movement, which is something we're going to be talking a little bit about. The relationship between Umoja, Ujima, and I Don't Know More, with this indigenous rights revolution that's happening. I have to, you know, pay my respects to Chief Teresa Spence. This is day 19 mm-hmm. of her hunger strike, with no word from the Prime Minister Harper, but what you're saying in terms of self-identity is something, you know, that really resonates deeply for Indigenous people here as well. I think, you know, anyone who experiences being racialized can relate to that, because of the the system of white supremacy, how it works. It's so multifaceted. You know, it operates in media, it operates in education, it operates in business, in economy, it operates on so many levels and in such an insidious way. So as you say, you know, many people often just for their own self-preservation take the path of least resistance. Mm. But what is that doing to them on a spiritual level, you know, regardless of their religious beliefs? You know, the spirit within suffers from chafing against white supremacy. So that teaching in particular is something that I find really interesting, and I think it's something that it goes outside of Pan-African, and it's something that relates to indigeneity and being racialized.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think one thing that's important to say is that indigeneity is not something that's just removed from Africans. There's indigenous right. peoples in Africa, which often is removed from the discourse. When you mm-hmm. hear indigenous, people don't often include African peoples in there. And that, yeah. again, I keep saying white supremacy, but that's a result of white supremacy. And that's why I say it's so important that we implicate ourselves in white supremacy, because we perpetuate those things to each other. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, the key to self-determination as well is that it's rooted in dialogue. It's rooted in having to have conversations with each other, because the fundamental difference between the way that capitalism positions us and the way that self-determination can reject those positions is that it allows us to inject ourselves into those stories. Part of colonialism, part of imperialism is that it claims to be chapter one when it came in chapter 150. Mm. And so the reason that people are perceived to take the path of least resistance is because those stories, we don't recognize ourselves in these stories. Mm-hmm. And the stories that we are told to recognize are those of savage, those of the uncivilized, those that we don't read, everything that we do and the way that we communicate with each other becomes pitted as or positioned as the inferior. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, because the inferior then is also feared. So we're caught between this weird paradox of being feared and then being told that we're nothing to be even thought of. So I think self-determination, the way that we can really use it as a transformative viewpoint, is that if we use it as a point of discussion. So it makes me then ask you, if me and you are walking down the street, for instance, and something happens, I ask you something like, what does it feel for you to be protected? Rather than to assume, based on patriarchal and capitalist notions, that I then need to do this, this, and this for you to feel protected. Mm. So agency then gets put back into that. So I think self-determination is a good framework and starting point in order to turn around this notion that we're never written into these stories, but even take it further, that these stories don't even recognize it when we get written into them. So mm-hmm. I think those are, the, for me anyway, important factors.
I think connected to that too, like the response to that has been that, you know, that we were kings and queens, right? And then it's like, how do we, within that, talk about how we, there's a myriad of histories in which we experience, you know, it's you know, more than likely, you know, my ancestors could have been servants, and I'm okay with that, because there's resistance at all levels of how we participated in challenging imperialism and challenging capitalism and patriarchy. So I think that's important as well.
Because it becomes easier in those moments to go to the extreme and right. mix the complexities that are in between. So then what that says is, only if our ancestors were kings and queens are we worthy to be having these conversations, right? So, yeah, I appreciate you saying that.
But again, to me, the king and queen narrative is, again, we accommodating ourselves to European history.
Right.
Where it's a history of the ruling groups in society. Right. But when I look at African history, I have no identification with kings and queen, because as someone who, you know, grew up in the working class, still identify with the working class. The working class history is different from the history of the rulers.
Right.
And they're always a small part of the society. And to me, they're a parasitic element in terms of how they appropriate the product of the labor of the producing class. So I identify with the groups who are resisting, nations that were incorporated into African empires as vassal states, paying tributes to empires and kingdoms. I will identify with those people rebelling against empires. So it's very much centered on how we view history and how we view struggles and who do we identify with. Unless you have like a progressive leader like Queen Nzinga being part of a ruling group, but, you know, stood against slavery, opposed her brother who was collaborating with the Dutch and the Portuguese. Like, you will identify with that and say, so this is a progressive leader who was fighting for her people and trying to end enslavement, or, you know, limit European encroachment. So and that's why it's so important for us to understand how we got here. For the Africans in the Americas, it wasn't because of white supremacy as the initial reason. It was a need for a servile labor force in the Caribbean. Because the fact that you had indentured whites and enslaved Africans working side by side in the Caribbean and also in the United States, to me, it's suggestive that it had nothing to do initially with the inferiority of African people. That came later on to justify our enslavement. Mm-hmm. And the fear that indentured whites and enslaved Africans could make common cause, that was also a factor in eventually stopped using indentured white workers and use enslaved African workers. So the need for us to look broadly and in an integrative way at systems of oppression and how they intersect is fundamental to the act of self-determination, because the one oppression lens is not going to work in Anaska. That's not, that was my experience, because I grew up in a country where the Africans were in power. The judge was going to send me to prison as a working class person. The police, after 10 in our community, we don't take check as young men, because you know, we could get a charge on us, we could just get beaten down, and we're glad to get beaten up and sent home. Because, you know, if you go into the jail, you just don't know how it's going to end up. Those are experiences that cause me not to have no identification with Africans who are part of ruling groups. And so we're talking about self-determination, we're talking about a complex story and how we're going to put it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And that certainly ties into where I want this conversation to go, which is to look at the intersectionality. Self-determination is critical. Understanding history, whole story, is really critical as well. But then looking also at our relationship here and in here and now on Turtle Island, which is Indigenous land, with you know, a movement that is taking place to revitalize indigenous self-identity and sovereignty. And I think it's a really critical conversation because, for one, you know, there are just too many parallels, I think, between, you know, people who experience racialized oppression, in particular people who are descendants of the enslaved Africans and indigenous people here on Turtle Island. There are too many parallels to not have this dialogue and to not recognize how, you know, there's something of value in having a collective sort of understanding of the relationship that and the power that can come from a sort of a solidarity movement. And that's what this I Don't Know More movement is. It started as a solidarity movement. It started amongst the women. It was a group of women in Saskatchewan who saw that, you know, they needed to take a stand against this, you know, it's a white supremacist system. Harper is like none other we've ever seen. So it's like next level white supremacy now coming from Parliament, for Indigenous people, you know, with the legislation that he is, enforcing unilaterally. I mean, Bill C-45 is the one that a lot of people are talking about, but there's a whole suite of legislation coming through, and it is directly targeting Indigenous people. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what your thoughts are as you celebrate Kwanzaa, as you talk about these teachings, in particular for community. My understanding, Ujima, is that community work. So do either one of you care to share any thoughts about that? And if you see any sort of bridges that we can build with that teaching in mind?
I mean, talking about indigeneity is often very complex, and in that it requires you to think about positionality, it requires you to think about the, like Ajamu was saying earlier, the intersectionalities that occur when you're talking about indigeneity, because it's not as simple as we often perceive it to be. Like one point I was making earlier about how oftentimes when we think of indigenous peoples, African peoples are removed from that conversation. Or when we talk about indigenous peoples and we see a black face, then we don't associate that with being indigenous to this land per se. Right. But there's complex histories there of intersectional oppressions that have happened. Mm-hmm. In terms of Stephen Harper, though I think his policies are more outright in terms of being anti-black and anti-indigenous, I would maybe challenge you on the term that he's worse. I think that the system itself is built for people like Stephen Harper, and that there's many ways in which the state has created systems that allow him now to be able to be this clear about his desire for the removal of anything that would challenge capitalist, patriarchal, white supremacist systems. So I think I Don't Know More is interesting in that it's bringing a conversation that's been happening in communities for years and years into a national framework. But it's, again, interesting in the way that we see the news depicting it and who's a part of that conversation, and also the refusal by mainstream media, for example, to talk about how this is directly related with the omnibus crime bill, how this is directly related with the omnibus immigration changes that have been happening, which are affecting the way in which we can have conversations on a national stage about these complexities and about these intersections of oppressions. I think that there's a beauty in the fact that women are at the center of this movement. I think that it challenges patriarchy and heteronormative notions of who it is that are strong movement leaders. I think there's a beauty in that there's a decentralized aspect to it. in that there's self-determined local initiatives that are happening and conversations that are happening in local communities. And that, for me, is the beginning of a sustainable long-term movement, because it's happening in different communities, though related to each other, but not dependent on each other.
I have to agree with you with everything you said there. And I appreciate, you know, the challenge to my statement about him being worse. He certainly is fulfilling a role that the system has allowed him to fulfill.
And has created. Yeah. And he's a perfect vessel, you know. He's absolutely perceived to be this educated, stoic man who's about his business and about making sure that the numbers make sense. And if these indigenous people had taken care of their business, they wouldn't be in the state that they're in now. So you can see the arc, the narrative has begun years ago from liberal governments, from provincial governments, and it's now culminating in a particular way with Stephen Harper. But Stephen Harper is but one person. And there'll be 100 Stephen Harpers after that, you know, or in before it and currently. So
definitely. And I think we're seeing that with as you say, you know, this Omnibill C-45, I mean, it's a 452-page document. It has so many different acts in it that are attacking indigenous people, the environment, you know, refugees, and then, of course, you know, the plan for, you know, the crime bill. I mean, it's a unilateral attack on everybody. And so in terms of Ujima and the work that, you know, can happen between these communities, because as you say, you know, they're in particular for First Nations communities, there are, you know, over 600 nations, there are thousands of communities who are each dealing with their own issues. Some of them are related, some of them are not. But what we're seeing is, and I think this is something that Harper probably did not anticipate, what we're seeing is some unity happening and solidarity on the ground that, hey, we're all under attack here. And you know, we have a voice, we have a self-determined identity, and we have youth in particular, I think, are really critical to this movement, because, you know, they are empowered in ways that, you know, maybe the last generation wasn't empowered. And I think a lot of that has to do with social media giving people a voice where they didn't have a voice before. And so when we look at what's happening in the media, it becomes a farce of itself and becomes a satire of itself, because, you know, we have this pushback from social media. We have, you know, so many bloggers, so many tweeters, so many people on Facebook who are creating dialogue where to fill that void and to fill that gap. Certainly it doesn't permeate for the mainstream in ways that we would like, but I think that it's certainly allowing for people to feel empowered where they wouldn't have before. So I have a lot of hope and faith for the youth, but I'm curious to know what, again, to get back to Ujima and how that fits in to this movement, because we are all here as part of a community in a sense. So,
well, I would say all of the principles of Kwanzaa, of the Nguzo Saba, you know, are relevant to this discussion, because if we talk about unity, and even though when we talk about unity in terms of Kwanzaa, we're talking about unity among African people in our communities and families and, you know, within the race. But it's also talking about, you know, the unity of purpose and the consolidation of the forces that are resisting the different forms of oppression. So indigenous people opposing capitalism, white supremacy, you know, there's a basis for unity with African people who we have very intimate experience with capitalism in terms of the enslavement and also in terms of white supremacy and the continued racial oppression. So there is a basis for unity. But even in the past, there's been unified actions between us. But also, you know, in that narrative, when we talk about unity and the interaction between African people here in the Americas and the indigenous people, there are also elements of our history that we need to take account of in terms of we think about the Buffalo Soldiers and the role that they play in the pacification of the indigenous people, but also that indigenous nations who also participated in the enslavement. But we also have stories and narratives of cooperation between different indigenous nations and African people in terms of providing refuge. So we're all exposed to, you know, white supremacist ideas of each other. And we will buy into some of those things, and those things will will prevent us from working together. So when we're talking about unity, we need to be frank about the full narrative between the different peoples and use that as a basis for moving forward. And if you talk about self-determination, again, it's around that. Like, we're not passive elements, people without agency, people who can't define the future that we want for ourselves. And again, you know, Kujichagulia's self-determination speaks to that. The question of Ujima and the collective work and responsibility that we need. For me, I like what I see going on, but at some level, it's people are being mobilized. But fundamentally, if we're going to do the work of liberation, we need to organize the people, provide them the skills, the knowledge, and the type of attitude that can push against the forces of oppression, and also create spaces for us to almost like try to live the values, live the practices that we anticipate in the liberated future. You know, that to me, that's fundamentally necessary. But right now, if we think about collective work and responsibility, Ujima, there's just not enough of us doing the work of liberation in terms of working in activist organizations and consistently carrying out the task and carrying out the responsibilities that are required to effect our liberation. So it's, and one thing I should also say about this, you know, I don't know more movement, is that, you know, white folks and other racialized people shouldn't look on the indigenous people as the shock troops of resistance or the cannon fodder. Because now that we see the indigenous people in motion, we should be getting in motion and fighting the system, because what we want to do is create multiple fronts on which the system is going to fight on, rather than just saying, oh, it's so great we have the indigenous people. Because I see Naomi Klein talking about, we're so grateful to have the indigenous people. But the indigenous peoples are not cannon fodder. They're not the shock troops of resistance. We also need to go out there and to put our material interests on the line in organizing against the forces of oppression, and also creating positively the type of structures that we would like to see. So we need to stop making it seem like this is only about the indigenous people, but because we're also oppressed. All of these, this omnibus legislation, it impacts all of us.
Thank you for that. That's kind of what I was getting at with wanting to bring this conversation to the table, because I think there are these parallels, and we need to recognize them. And I really appreciate what you're saying about, you know, indigenous people being on the front line. I mean, I think in some ways, you know, as a catalyst for a group of movements, that's fine. It's good that it is indigenous people leading the way. But I think that it should be inspiring people to come to the table as well and come to the front line as well. And I think it is. I see that happening. And but I'm curious to know about some of the fundamental teachings of things like Kwanzaa, cultural teachings that are informing, because protocol is really important to indigenous people here on Turtle Island. Protocol is key. If you're going to do anything, you have to follow protocol. Because, you know, for various reasons, for protection of the people, for protection of the land, for protection of the culture and the language and identity. And so I'm curious about protocol in this movement, because I think it's an important factor to consider. Adnan, welcome to the show.
I was wondering, Jemais, was that a question, or could I tack a slightly different course?
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was actually wondering, because in the Saba, I find reflected a sense of opposition to this, to the construction of the individual, in particular, because it seems that the individual as a project of modernity is a failed project, that it results in a predatory form of capitalism and results in a form of where self-interest, if it's placed highest, then it becomes something very problematic when we're trying to then live together in groups. And like I find when the African Charter of Rights and Freedoms was being drafted, one of the concerns was that it was highlighting the duties and responsibilities of families and groups which were not just merely individuals, which was sort of flying in the face of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and things like that, which sort of explicitly extracted this kind of enlightenment notion of an individual and plants it in the 20th century as this sort of supreme arbiter of their own destiny. So I'm wondering, is this how does this notion of kind of umoja and just generally maybe even the reflection of the whole Saba reflect that modernity's failed project has been the individual? I get that sense, but I'm wondering if that's just me sort of tacking my own course or my own take on it.
I think it depends on how you're looking at it as a failed project. I think in particular ways, it's been very successful in the ability to divide and conquer communities and movements, in that the individual has been used in movement building as a way to remove people from their communities. So the notion of a leader, when it's rooted in Enlightenment's understanding of the individual, is that that person has something outside of community, has something inherently better and different than community. So then what at the very start of that project happens is already a divisive factor. Whereas I think that the principles of Kwanzaa and the purpose of creating alternative discourses that don't just put us in the margins, because then we're discourses of white supremacy still, is that it allows for people to lead together in interchangeable and dynamic ways without removing people from community or giving them particular things that are inherently better. So you see this oftentimes, and part of the pitfalls of movement building that's happening now is that you have five or six people that you'll see on CBC, you'll see on like Media Co-op or whatever, and it's this notion that these people are inherently more articulate or somehow have a better understanding of revolution or liberation than, let's say, the grandmother who's been feeding the kids, or let's say the bus driver who every day lets a youth on that doesn't have the money to go so that that youth can get to school, whatever it may be. And I think in that way, the principles of Kwanzaa and the dialogue that's inherent in these principles provides a beautiful challenge, in that it highlights the failures of the Enlightenment project. Mm. But at the same time, I think we need to heed the way that capitalism has used the individual as a way to make you feel like you have purpose and that you have a reason for being. Whereas in movement building, when things are messy and when things don't really always make sense, and when something makes sense right now, but 2 weeks later, a different situation comes up and we can't necessarily, and that's what I found interesting about your understanding of protocol, and I think we'd have to talk more about it, but inherently I kind of squirm a little when I hear protocol, because then that means the way that we're approaching situations are based on things that we've done in the past, which may work, but which may not work. So long as that protocol that you're talking about is dynamic and fluid, then I think we're still providing a challenge to this notion of enlightenment and the way that the state has been built on, you know?
When I speak of protocol, in particular, to, you know, related to Turtle Island, related to Indigenous communities, I'm referring to something that, you know, requires you speak to an elder before you know, the protocols that allow for, and in fact, I think in many ways speaks to what you're talking about, because it removes the individual you know, every movement, often has some activists who it's about them. It becomes their show. And protocol is something that, you know, with my understanding from what I've learned, from what I've been taught, cultural protocols in indigeneity help to guide people away from that.
Okay. So, I figured that's what you meant by protocol, but I just thought I'd ask for clarification. Mm-hmm. And again, this is not to say that individuals are completely removed from the discourses that we have, because we'll bring different experiences and lived experiences to have these conversations, but it is to say that the individual is not the center of those conversations, but rather it's part of a myriad of, conversations, to be a bit redundant.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the question of the individual, in for me, is part of the liberal project in terms of philosophical liberalism. But for me, I'd like to contrast the role that the individual plays in liberal theory and in liberal capitalist society, such as Canada, to a common theme or philosophical orientation that exists in many different African culture. And it's this idea that I am because we are, and because we are, therefore I am. So the individual's identity is also rooted in the collective, but even the collective identity is also reflective of individuality in those societies. So you can't, and to me that reflect really fundamental values in society, because I can't define myself outside of my group context. Because I'm fundamentally a social animal, that the collective impact on me in the same way that I could also influence and shape the collective or shape the collective decisions that create us. But a lot of times when we talk about individualism, we don't really look at liberalism as the basis for that. And because we use liberalism in a very colloquial sense, that you're open-minded, you know, like you believe in differences, people mix up. You know, the philosophical and the colloquial, and they may not even be aware of the philosophical underpinning of, you know, when of the notion of being liberal or being individually oriented. So even people that we, like Stephen Harper, he's a liberal. You know, Obama is a liberal. Mitt Romney is a liberal, based on the ideas that they have, that society is fundamentally about individuals pursuing their end. Even the notion of the state, the role that the state plays, is to facilitate the individual pursuit of self-determined ends. And that's what it really should be. So a lot of times when we're calling people liberals, I say, oh, this person is individually oriented. They all are. Even the NDP is part of a liberal project, because it has a fundamental idea of the role of the state. It also believes in the notion of equality of opportunity, which means that if I have the resources, I can get the best post-secondary education, and if you don't, then you don't get it. But there's no legal barrier stopping any one of us from acquiring post-secondary education. We just don't have the means. So when we talk about equality of opportunity, it's part of that individualist liberal project that's around, as opposed to those of us who are committed to socialism, who believe in equality of condition or equality of outcomes. So if I want to be an artist and someone want to be a doctor, the resources will be there to facilitate those ends that we want, as opposed to under capitalism or liberal capitalist society, where if you don't have the means to pursue those ends, then you're nothing. But again, it's all up to the individual. So the state should play a very, very limited role in ensuring a level playing field to people achieving the ends that they set up for themselves. But the idea of protocol, or even just the role of the individual in leadership projects or in movement, I think Ella Baker is someone that all of us or activists need to become more acquainted with, in terms of her approach to leadership that centers the people, the group, in leadership. And, you know, she's a woman and an African, so probably that's part of the reason why we don't know much about her and her approach to leadership. And one of the things I should say is that, even though for me, like, I'll read her work and I'm thinking, oh, shit, like, how do you shift to that form of leadership, even though you believe in it philosophically, but in practice, how do you actually engage in that more patient approach to leadership and to nurture and to develop other people and to shift the attention from individuals? Because everything in our movement and in our society kind of push towards this kind of the superstar out there shaping ideas, shaping movements, setting priorities. And even we, the oppressed, sometimes we facilitate that through inaction or just ideological conditioning.
I think this is really the big question when we're talking about, you know, the movement of African peoples and partnering with First Nations communities right now at this time, especially looking at the class stuff that's happening. Like, I mean, I live downtown and I hang out with people who have this consciousness, but if I speak to my people out in the suburbs who have the house and the white picket fence about this, they're like, oh, sorry, people can't see me, but they're just like, sorry. Sometimes I forget that I don't have like a television camera in like my face all the time. Just diva tactics. But they're just like they have no idea, right? And like, even I had a friend who text messaged me. She's like, your newsfeed is feeding up, like filling up my screen. Like, basically stop posting so much stuff about all this, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's no way to comprehend and process this stuff and how it's relevant to them. And I'm like, how do I have these discussions in a responsible, patient way for people who not only are they not comprehensive of what's happening with First Nations people and us inclusively, but not even the experience of how oppression is working against people of African descent, mm-hmm. you know, despite having being middle classed and having a car and, you know, a job and all these things.
Yeah, and in many ways also I find that if you were to just look at it from an objective opinion, or if you were to look at it from the opinion of a liberal philosopher, and you were to say that this omnibus bill, there's not much objectionable in it, because in many ways it's trying to empower, in its opinion, it's trying to empower indigenous communities to function as individuals.
No.
It seems like a lot of it was part of this liberal project to empower you to own your own land, but it doesn't pay respect to the ways and the ownership and protocol,
it's problematic because I mean it's a very complicated issue, the issue of privatizing indigenous land and what that does. It sounds like it should be good for indigenous people, but because of things like economic suffering that communities have, you know, here we'll give you this little piece of land that is already yours, but we'll give it to you to sell,
mm-hmm.
and this is really, you know, the only asset you have now. So, and then what happens, you know, one individual sells a piece of land and then bit by bit indigenous land is gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's because I feel that liberalism has a lot of trouble dealing with badly behaved individuals. So, if, mm-hmm. for example, if the person has a notion of the good that doesn't fit with the general society's notion of the good, like if they're religious and they're voting for someone because God told them to vote for someone, that suddenly becomes problematic for liberalism, because those are illiberal values on which they're voting on. Or if you're voting on it because it's based on interest which is other than self-determination and individual responsibility, and this construction of the individual as a property owner, economically self-sufficient and things like that, like it becomes, I think the omnibus bill is part of a liberal project. It's a natural extension of a liberal project. It has to extinguish individuals who don't behave well, like I think First Nations people. Mm-hmm. And this is just the next step of it.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I had to take a call.
I wanted, I guess, to ask, you know, how do we have those, knowing what the agenda is, and how do we have those patient conversations? How, through your work, have you been having those patient conversations with folks? Because I think ultimately we want to build ways, like, how can work be done within our communities and build those, mm-hmm. So that can lead to allyships and different fronts happening.
Yeah, it's something I think that Ajamu touched on earlier, and that, like, as I do more and more and more work, I'm realizing more and more that it's futile to have arguments with people on why my idea is better or more radical or revolutionary than yours. What I think works and is sustainable is when you're doing work in community that begins to materially and spiritually and emotionally affect the lives of people. So if I'm sitting here and going on and on about police brutality, instead of having theoretical conversations about it, I think it's more useful to sit and have these conversations while at the same time building viable alternatives that community members create rather than us parachuting organizers, activists, thinkers, academics into communities and saying this is what you should do. Mm. But when the things, radio language, when things happen, then where is everybody? Then it's the community that's already being oppressed, that's already having to face these things day in and day out, get more of it without any sense of support. So for me, to answer your question, it's doing work that's led by community members. And if you're not a part of those communities and have been asked, then acting in an allyship, in a support manner, which is, again, determined by what that community needs. Because oftentimes people think that allyship is an identity. Mm. Well, we are all of a sudden allies, and then that's it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it comes back down to, rather than having these, like, theoretical arguments about which philosophical viewpoint makes more sense in this particular conversation, it's about building viable alternatives. And when something makes sense for somebody, if somebody's hungry and you've managed to find an alternative way that doesn't require the state and, like, exploiting migrant workers in order to get food on someone's table, they're going to choose that method. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking and talking and their kids are still going hungry, at the end of the day, I got to feed my kids. So that, for me, is an alternative way to have those conversations with people. And once then you build trust with people, then those conversations will continue to go. And I think a movement is only successful in so far as it's not relying on one person to always be there. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm a part of a movement, for me, I feel good when I don't, if I'm not there and it works perfectly fine. If it requires me to always be there, then it's a practice of building ego. It's not a practice of building movements.
Absolutely. That was really a critical point. And I think about, you know, allies, and again, I come back to protocol because, you know, those are the things that sort of keep that in check. Mm-hmm. And the whole question around allyship and how to approach a particular community, in this instance, for this discussion, we're talking about Idle No More, the Indigenous revolution that we're seeing happening, and we're seeing a lot of allies coming to the table. And I'm seeing some in particular who I've seen at, you know, in other instances and in other movements, and it really does become about, you know, their work. They're trying to fit themselves in there somehow and build themselves up. But in terms of creating awareness outside of that and creating this dialogue, I think the critical thing is education. I mean, we are, you know, miseducated our whole lives if we are in the Eurocentric system. And so we have to do the work within our communities. That's the fundamental. That's something I'm hearing, you know, in a lot of Indigenous communities. They're talking about, you know, yes, Idle No More is great and flash mobs are fantastic. But what we really need is to do our own work, our own practices of cultural revitalization, language revitalization, our protocols. And then, you know, I think we need to look at education for each other as well, because I talk to a lot of folks who are misinformed about things like, you know, Indigenous communities and also Caribbean communities and Caribbean people who are misinformed about themselves. So, you know, that's a critical part of this any movement, right? Mm-hmm. Any sort of empowerment movement is having these dialogues be more than just lip service, as you're saying, mm-hmm. but have sort of action to back it up.
And I think education is very important, but you have to at this particular point, you have to desire it, right? And I want to, I guess, understand how we can educate people who don't even have an awareness of what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's very, I think these matters are very complicated for someone who's living relatively simply, right?
So they're all complicated regardless. I mean, colonization is complicated.
Right. So how do we engage youth in this discussion? I think that's what I'm more concerned of at this particular point. How do they understand that what is happening right now in Canada is relevant to their experience? And you know, I agree about, you know, asking permission on how to be allies, but how do we encourage other people that they need to be allies, right? And not going crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I would say, if we're talking about African youth and indigenous youth, if we look in terms of miseducation, if we look at the disciplinary regimes that are imposed on them in the educational system, mm-hmm. Their performance, they're very similar. If we're talking about overpopulation of the prison system mm-hmm. based on their makeup of the population or representation, we're talking about similar experience. If we talk about their unemployment rate, generally in Canada, the unemployment rate for young people or youth, it's usually almost twice the national unemployment rate. But when you look at indigenous youth and African youth, it's a national disaster. So there are points of similarity between their experience. If you talk about police containment, surveillance, these are youth who are experiencing that. So there's a basis for that. But how are we going to bring these youth together to realize that they need to build allyship? Because it's not a one-way thing. Is that when indigenous people are being attacked by the police, like, where are the African voices? But also, where are the indigenous voices when Africans are being attacked? Where we find our people being overrepresented in the prison system. Our communities are trying to attend to each community's particular need, but we're not integrating in a structural way to resist imprisonment, to resist the experiences in the school system. So there's a basis. So what, Luam was talking about in terms of responding to the needs, I think that's a viable basis. Mm-hmm. To pull people together, because we are so shaped by notions of self-interest, and if we realize that we can't do what we're trying to do independently, that joint action may bring better result, even if it starts out as being self-interested, mm-hmm. we may realize that in even the act of doing that, we start to know more about each other. And that's education, I think, is critically important, because many of us believe the stereotypes that we're seeing mm-hmm. out there about the indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And indigenous people may also be shaped by the white supremacist notion of African people. Mm-hmm. We need to do some work, but we have to start. We have to start that process, mm-hmm. and also to be consistent. That's one of the concern or reservation I've had in terms of doing indigenous sovereignty work, is that I know that I don't have the time, and if I'm not a part of a group where if I'm not available for 6 months, the work is still going on, and I'm sort of know what's going on, and I may be contributing, but maybe not on the front line, then I would be a part of that. But if you can't have something that's going to be consistent, you just come because a movement is around, and 2 months later you just mm-hmm. gone back to your own affairs, that's not going to build the type of sustainable solidarity that we need. And
yeah, and I was thinking about that because, we need to just take a quick break. We missed our break at the half hour mark. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to The Vibe Collective on CAUT. We'll be back after this very, very brief message, CAUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CAUT 89.5 FM, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back on The Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to keep this conversation going. It's too good to stop. What you were just saying, Ajamu, makes me think about the Yinka Dene Alliance that we saw. They came through in, I think it was the beginning of May of this year. And the Yinka Dene Alliance were a group of indigenous people who had been traveling around Turtle Island to create awareness for the pipelines that are, trying to go through their territory without their permission. And it was a huge movement. They were creating a lot of awareness. You were seeing a similar sort of support from all over Turtle Island. And then they came here and they had a big show. Manifesto got behind it. Mm. And it was, it was great because you saw this sort of intersection of communities coming together for this cause. And then I'm wondering, where are all those people now with Idle No More? Where are all those people in support of this movement as, it continues? So I think that's a really critical thing that, people need to call on themselves to think about in terms of social responsibility. And again, this idea of, you know, the fact that there are these parallels for the oppression of people of African descent and indigenous people here on Turtle Island. And, you know, we're seeing that. We're seeing this unilateral legislation attacking, you know, both groups at the same time. So in terms of a social responsibility and a social conscience, I mean, that's one thing. But, you know, these things are very deeply connected. This legislation is attacking everybody.
I think thinking about my own personal experience, you know, one, there's two things that need to be done. Is one is act as sort of a translator, right? Mm-hmm. So being able to speak within the Black, the African community about, you know, what's happening and how it affects us and what are maybe the small things that people can do that make it safe for them, right? Because mm-hmm. in a way it's scary, right? People are like, you want me to do what? Like, right? And the other thing is talk about the things that I'm doing as well, right? Beyond just reposting things on mm-hmm. on social networking sites, right? Like if I'm going out to a protest, or if I'm, you know, giving a little bit of money in certain places, or going out to a Kwanzaa event, you know, like these are the little things we have to talk about. Because a lot of times I'll say, oh, I did this. And people be like, well, why didn't you tell me about it? And I'm like, I don't think about that, but we have to kind of promote the things that we're doing in small different ways so that people become engaged, right? Because some people just don't know what's going on, not that they even don't want to.
Mm-hmm. If I could also return to an earlier point, like we were discussing a little bit about working on education and the house of education, it's sort of the one place in which I'm consistently disappointed with human rights activists or social activists or people generally involved in the civil sector is that the education models still tend to take, like to borrow Ferry's term, like this banking model, right? Mm. That I have all the knowledge, you have none of the knowledge, and I'm going to teach you what you need to know. And I find that kind of model still persists to such an extent, especially when it comes to these things like core rights, when it comes to explaining to people like how a system is unjust and how they have to struggle against it. I find that it often falls into these patterns of you're so stupid that you can't even understand your oppression. Mm-hmm. And I think it's consistently the most troublesome thing I find, especially as someone involved in education myself, is that I struggle a lot with trying to figure out what is that balance is between me as someone who's standing in front of the room and being paid to be in the room and the other people who are paying for it. And I don't know how that dynamic is meant to work, but I know when the model feels right, and it feels right when my students are comfortable challenging me and challenging the readings I give them or working with me through these concepts and ideas. And it doesn't work when I have to force them to understand something. And I don't know how to better work on that ideal of education. I'm partially perhaps things like Kwanzaa, which are built into a cultural, trying to build a cultural institution built on notions of shared heritage, is maybe something more powerful because it's meant to be an integrated festival. It's not meant to be one which teaching takes place from a pulpit. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I mean, when I think about, you know, the education aspect in all of this work, I don't think about academia. I think about a community sense and looking at paradigms that make sense to communities that are nonlinear, that allow for the teacher-student relationship to be fluid. I mean, it's not, it goes both ways in a meaningful way. You know, it's just that the Eurocentric system ignores that. But I'm sure, you know, even in a linear classroom, teachers are learning from their students. They just won't acknowledge that. Students are teachers, teachers are students. And that's a critical aspect for youth to understand. And I think, you know, it's what has disempowered youth is exactly what you're saying, that, you know, I am the teacher, I have all this knowledge, I'm going to give it to you, rather than we're going to share our learning, we're going to share our knowledge, we're going to share our thoughts, and we're going to learn from each other. That's the aspect of education I think we need to get back to within our communities and in our homes and at our dinner tables. Having dinner together, I think, is critical. Sharing meals and sharing the conversation. You know, a lot of families are working and don't always have time to share those meals together. But, you know, something as simple as having these conversations as you nourish yourself, as you nourish your soul, is a critical part of that education. And that revitalizing those traditions of oral traditions and how oral tradition works.
I think that's important. And maybe this is what I was getting at before. You know, how are we going? I mean, having dinner and talking about these things is really important. But how are we going to get into spaces where we can educate people en masse, right? We're not going to be welcomed necessarily into the current educational system, right? We're not necessarily going to be welcome into mainstream religious spaces, right? I guess maybe community centers may be a space in which we can do these things, but there has to be a way in which we can act as translators and bring people to understand what the effects are of oppression and this particular movement. And I guess that's maybe what I want to hear from both of you on, like, how do we, because how can we educate if we don't have access to the people that we need to educate, mm-hmm. right?
We have access.
Okay.
We're not using it.
Okay.
We actually have to be in those spaces.
Right.
Today's a Saturday. I think it was Thursday, the Ujima night of Kujichagulia self-determination night. I went to Young and Potential Fathers Kwanzaa event, and a young brother came up to me and he was saying, look, I need to shake your hand. Because the information that you shared with us at this workshop about Know Your Rights around policing,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was able to stop a police from searching me. And he had searched me in the past, but I told him that you can't search me because I'm not doing anything. And if you do it, I'm going to report this to the station. And he was just saying that he didn't realize you could actually tell a police that. Because in the past, they would come up to him and say, oh, you look suspicious. Or, no, you fit the description of a suspect and I want to search you. And they would just allow them to search. And I'm saying that you're not a suspect in a crime. You're not in the process of committing a crime. There's no reason for you to give them your information. Even though he was able to get him kicked out of the library because he went to the librarian and said, oh, these young people that use the library space to deal drugs. And he said he was just there reading, but he left. And I'm saying, even then, your rights were violated. But for us to work with people to defend their rights, we have to be in those spaces, mm-hmm. in those communities, organizing and building their capacity to resist. And again, as Loam said, it's around their needs, because these youth in the the Western Road, Mount Dennis area, they experience a lot of over-policing and police surveillance and containment. So they have a need. They're sick and tired of police always asking them for information. Mm-hmm. So even this thing around the 208 card where police will come and ask your name, address, name of your associate. They'll look and see if you have tattoos on your body and we'll take those down.
Wow.
The people do not have to give that information. Right. But what the city of Toronto is doing is coming up with these receipts where the police will have to give you a receipt stating why it is they stop you, your race. But it shouldn't reach there. You're not a suspect. Mm-hmm. And if I'm a suspect, take me in.
Yeah. Right.
Take me in. So we shouldn't be giving the police these type of information. So there's a basis on which we can work with people. Their parents who may not have the skills and the knowledge to negotiate with the educational system around their children. As activists, we should be organizing around those needs, their employment needs, where there are people whose rights are violated, whether it's through the Employment Standards Act. We can organize around those things. And by organizing the people now, they may be more open to revolutionary ideas and also emphasizing the need to be in organizations. Organize, because that's the only way we're going to move a struggle forward is by being in an organization where we're consistently working to change the oppressed condition, because it's not going to happen individually. Because we can see even leaders, when you look at Marcus Garvey, once he was detached from the movement, he was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's only movements that makes us strong, because mm-hmm. we have all other people surrounding us and giving us energy and we giving energy. You know, we have access to the people, but we have to organize our resources to effect change, because, you know, we're too busy for one person to always be available. Right. When we have a collective doing it,
mm-hmm.
we can get it done. So I believe we have access, because many of us are members of religious organizations. And outside of the Friday prayers or Saturday or Sunday, there are other groups inside these religious organizations. And we can, as members, we're part of it, and we can bring ideas or mm-hmm. you know, propose projects that we should do to work with the people. We have access. We're just not using it.
We're putting a call out.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I think what's key, though, is feeling that you're part of a movement, because when I've been arrested and they've asked me questions, like my goal is to try and leave the situation as an easy a manner as possible. I do not want to be detained any longer than necessary, especially if they've got you in an interrogation room and like a camera and stuff on you. It's terrifying. And I can understand why people don't want to go through that and resist by saying you don't have the right to do this. Mm-hmm. But if you empower people to feel like they're part of a movement, that your objection, like there was a lawyer that wrote an article last year about crashing the system in the U.S. because most of the cases go to the decision by the prosecutor, so a plea bargain as opposed to going to a jury. And if every person demanded their right to a jury, you would crash the U.S. legal system. Mm-hmm. And that would be it would be perfect, because it would show how the system is inherently there's a hypocrisy built into the system that it has to deny you jury to function. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this recognition that you're part of a movement and that you're part of something larger than just your perhaps this individual suffering that you're experiencing at this moment, like being able to maybe be cannon fodder, being willing to be cannon fodder is difficult. It's very hard.
Mm. You're not going to be a cannon fodder, because one of the things is that the Network for Pan-African Solidarity in the new year, we will be making a call out to stakeholders who are involved in, who are interested in policing issues, to develop structured response. So if the police take you in and you're part of an organized structure where it may be 3 a.m. in the morning and they take you in and you believe it's wrongly, you can call a number and a lawyer will speak to them and say, look, my client will not say anything further. He doesn't wish to be interviewed and I'll be coming down. But we need something structured. When people get arrested, we need to have the progressive lawyers that can, whether pro bono or they're taking legal aid, but they're committed to it and they're going to get full attention. And so we can have structured response. So when you go in, you're not afraid to go inside a police station because you know you've got a massive behind
you. You're not isolated.
And that's the fear that people have. We need to break that fear, and it can only happen through organizations, through structured programs and projects to make people lose their fear. The minute we lose our fear of the enemies, we're gonna move. We're gonna make progress, but it can only be done through organized response.
Mm-hmm. I need to just take a break, because I know Loem, you have to head out.
I have to go. Yes, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. It was really, really great to have your voice in this conversation. You've made some really, really critical points in this. Reasoning session, and it was great to have you in this.
Thank you
for joining us. So we'll let Luem go on her way, and as we do that, I'm going to go to a quick song. This is a track that I found on the Idle No More blog for Idle No More. It's called Idle No More. It's by a young artist from the West Coast named Hebes the Earth Child. You're listening to The Vibe Collective, and we'll be back after this very brief track on CIUT 89.5 FM.
It's a cold song with the heart of my elders. This an old song. We have to go strong when they hold bonds. Those politicians with their souls gone. We row on the river that we flow on and keep showing the world what we know is wrong. My eagle eyes are sharper than the scissors held by the barber. Cutting the braids of the rivers, that's a cut to and from Stephen Hartford. Your treason is harder than the stone in your heart, sir. I see more pride as we fight. Pussy 45 will make you mortified that you ever tried to attack a people who stand 45. This land is for the lies who stand for truth and not for lies. I know what I'm fighting for and what I'm fighting for. You know what I'm fighting for this, I don't know more. We'll be right back.
idle no more, idle no more, idle no more.
Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. The track was Idle No More by Hebes the Earth Child. And we've been talking with Ajamu Nangwaya from the Network for Pan-African Solidarity. And Luam Kudani, who just had to, she had to go on her way, but a big thanks to her. And we've been talking today about a mix of things, about Kwanzaa, the teachings of Kwanzaa, Umoja, Ujima. I can't pronounce the one for self-identity. Let me turn on your mics. How about that? This is not the Jam Show. One for self-identity.
Oh, in terms of Kujichagulia, self-determination, that's the second principle of Kwanzaa.
Yes.
But, and also today is a very significant day because it's about cooperative economics,
yep.
or Ujamaa. And it's really about sharing the social wealth that is the result of collective labor, which means it's very much oppositional to capitalism, where it's based on individual ownership of the wealth, the resources in society. Mm-hmm. Because we cannot produce any wealth without labor. Labor is the most fundamental factor. Even what we call capital, if workers don't unite with natural resources, what we call capital, whether we have buildings, a tractor trailer, tools to enhance production, is impossible without labor. Okay, if you have the iron ore in the soil, it's just there. But labor has to go there, intellectual labor and physical labor, and transform it into something else. And even when we say capital is a separate factor of production or mean, you know, it is not really, because even if we talk about money capital, without labor, it's not possible. Even if we talk about the tractor trailer, without we foregoing consumption and putting away something, we won't have money capital. And, you know, so labor is central to production, it's central to the creation of wealth, and yet it's exploited and abused and oppressed and treated as an ingredient, like an ingredient in a Big Mac. Mm. That's how labor is treated, but yet it's so fundamental to it. So when we talk about cooperative economics, we're talking about something that is not about black capitalism or capitalism, period. It's about we cooperatively producing wealth and equitably sharing in it. Because again, when we talk about the earlier values of I am because we are, and because we are, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. That type of value system won't tolerate people sleeping in the street while we have unoccupied homes. Mm-hmm. Or even it wouldn't tolerate people being homeless, because if it means they have to sleep on the floor in the living room, mm-hmm. we're going to have somewhere for you to sleep. It means that we're not going to be in a space of plenty and there are people who are hungry, or there are children where we're going to say, well, I don't want children with different abilities in this classroom because they're going to slow down my child. Mm-hmm. No, we will say, okay, then the children who are faster will help those who we think are not as fast. It's a different type of value system, because if we don't progress collectively, then What is a society about? You know, that's truly a society that believes in leaving no one behind. Mm-hmm. And today, the cooperative economics, for some people, when they think about Ujamaa or cooperative economics, they think it means as supporting any black business.
Yeah.
Where, oh, just buy black. But an African capitalist will be just as exploitative as a white capitalist.
Right.
And we know that, because mm-hmm. someone who was born in the Caribbean, in an African space, some of those visited Africa and have seen the situation. We live here and we'll see how capitalists treat each other. But a lot of times, like, ethnicity may be used by that particular capitalist as a basis to, you know, pull the people together. So most of the workers, for example, if you go to Chinatown, you find many of the workers in very exploitative situation, worse than in even white capitalist businesses. But they use ethnicity as a kind of social glue to tie the people in that type of exploitative situation. And of course, they're exploiting the vulnerability of people because they may be undocumented or, mm-hmm. you know, because of white supremacy in the wider labor market. A business owned by a Chinese capitalist provides the opportunity for employment, but they will use that to exploit it. So cooperative economics is about a different type of economics than capitalism economics. And to me, it's a very, very important value. And it's universal. Mm-hmm. All of the principles of Kwanzaa are relevant to all peoples, especially oppressed ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about how capitalism relies on the oppression of others, it relies on it. I mean, as you pointed out, you know, the way in which labor is treated as an ingredient, and often, you know, we see people being treated as disposable within that paradigm. So that the idea of looking for other ways of sustaining an economy, it doesn't have to be in a capitalist paradigm. It can be in a gift economy. It can be in a a trade economy. There are other paradigms that have sustained for time immemorial, but we're often fooled into believing that, oh, this is the only way in capital. You know, I just growing up in the 80s and hearing, you know, oh, commies as you know, being pitted as something that's bad and capitalism as something that's so great. But when you think about what the word actually means, to capitalize on something, to exploit it, it's very problematic. And when you think about the relationship between capitalism and colonization in particular, those two have relied on each other, and that's how they have grown into this web that covers us all. So I think that's a really critical thing for people to be thinking about as well, in terms of, you know, other ideas of doing things and other ways of doing things. It's an important teaching for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's so important when you're thinking, at least, and I think more than anything else, it involves being invested in the way in which you spend your money. Mm-hmm. I think especially is that there's a sense that you have to read labels. You have to be conscious of the fact that perhaps maybe buying shoes that were made by children in a factory somewhere is not in your best interest either. Right. Despite the fact that it might keep your feet warm on a day like today. But it's hard to kind of reframe that, because part of the way that the capitalism has functioned today is to make things which are produced under the worst circumstances the most readily available and affordable. Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to seduce you into that you could have it all if you were willing just to put aside some of your humanity. Mm-hmm. And that should be troublesome, I think, especially in a time of such intense consumerism as the end of the year. And I've forced myself not to buy anything for the last 2 weeks, and I'm feeling great. Except I had to buy a ramp for the cat because he couldn't get on the couch. So no, I built him one, but.
That's a whole other show. I want to hear more about that ramp. Okay, well, I want to thank Ajamu for coming in today. It was great to have you in the studio. I really enjoy hearing your insights. I enjoy reading your insights on Facebook. And it's been a pleasure having you here in this discussion today.
Okay, sister, thanks a lot for inviting me, and also Luamka. Both of us are in the same organization, the Network for Pan-African Solidarity, and Kemba, thanks for being a part of the discussion.
Yeah.
And
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Can we get some information about if people want to get involved with the Network for Pan-African Solidarity?
Right. It's an African organization. I would say African, we're talking about African people. It's because we believe it's fundamentally necessary for us to re-engage in radical activism, but activism that's also centered in the people that are responding to the needs of the people. And when we talk about self-determination, we do live in a white supremacist society, and next to the indigenous people in the society, African people are at the bottom of the pyramidal structure. In every level, if you talk about the prison system, the employment, there's almost like there's this hierarchical thing. It's still thing that, like, if you're white, you're all right. If you're yellow, you're mellow. You're brown, stick around. And if you're red, like, you're already dead or drop dead. But if you're black, get back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though those are games that children used to say, like, way back, like, when you look at it and look at in terms of statistical realities, you will see certain things. And we're saying, as African people, we need to pull progressive folks together and create progressive space. So, you know, I just want to make it clear that this is an African space. We can be reached by, we have a long email address. It's called, well, it is network for the number 4, panafricansolidarity@gmail.com. So it's network4panafricansolidarity@gmail.com. you can reach us. And we also, we're on Facebook, so if you want to reach us, you can inbox us. And we have monthly meetings. And also, you know, for next year, 2013, there are a lot of things that we'll be doing. We'll also be promoting Kwanzaa as a 24/7 thing, because these values need to inform our practices and our organizational work and activist work, but also around the policing. That's also a critical thing that we will be organizing around, because we realize that, as Luhamad mentioned earlier about building capacity in local communities, if we're going to approach policing, we need to have communities that are targeted to have their own organizing structures that may be linked up across the city with other similar organizations, but we need to build local capacity. And that's about education. And there was one thing I also want to talk about. When we talk about even like a non-banking approach, non-linear approach to teaching and education, we still must recognize that the facilitator or the animator may possess certain skills and knowledge that is not generalized, and because of material privilege in society, you're better placed to have access to certain information. So, but at the same time, a person experiencing things can teach a lot from their experience. But we shouldn't make it seem as if like the facilitator don't come with even more power than the other people in the process, because privileges endow us with certain skills and knowledge and attitude that place us in a differential relationship with even the people that we're working with. But I do understand what we're saying. It's not like I'm depositing knowledge in your brain, but at the same time, recognize that there's a facilitative role that the educator or the animator is playing, which is a little different and give them a little bit more power in that educational process. Because what I've seen even at OISE, where people will say, oh, well, I'm no longer like a teacher. And I'm saying, no, don't abandon that role. But it's a balance. So you just come and you just have everybody just kind of talking. But there's certain experience that you take and certain knowledge take to this process and knowledge that you have that we still must do some amount of teaching, but create a space where people are also coming up with their own ideas and raising things. They ain't going to be blown away by some things that people are saying, anything, oh, shit, I've never thought of it that way. Or, oh, I'm not aware of this. And you're learning. But there's still a role for the facilitator, which is not just like you just, it's an unfortunate situation that, because you could have people experiencing police violence, but you have some folks who, because they've been studying this thing or they know about it or they've experienced organizing around it, they may enter a community and start to ask people questions like, what are the issues around policing? And they're able to pull people together because they even may have outside resources like lawyer networks, even law professors or, law students that they can pull those resources together. And that's a different role than just like the regular people who may be, because you may not even be experiencing police violence, but because of study and the social capital that you have and the networks that you're part of, that you can bring something to the process. But then the people themselves is going to take it, and after time you won't even be needed. It just fade away into the background, and but in the initial process you may end up playing a greater role than most people in that process. But the challenge is not to overplay your role where you become like the god in that process, And it's hard in practice. In theory, it's very clear, analytically clear about what you should do or shouldn't do. So again, you can contact the Network for Pan-African Solidarity at Pan-African Solidarity, and it's African with a K, at gmail.com. Or go to Facebook and like our page and send us a message, and we'll get back in touch with you.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Ajamu, again for joining us today. And I want to give a shout out once again to Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen, who has been listening and tweeting at us. So big shout out to her. Big shout out to Adrian Worrell as well. Hopefully he will be feeling better. This is our last show of 2012. We'll be back next year. And we're not quite over. I've got a little bit of music lined up for you. So you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We'll be back after this message.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, go ahead.
I want to say happy Earth Strong to Zainab. Today is
yes.
her birthday.
Yes, thank you.
So I want to say happy birthday to
good
her.
Yeah. Big, big, big shout out to her. Yeah. Big love to her. Okay, so we'll be back on The Vibe Collective CAUT 89.5.